Take your Bibles and turn over to Esther, and that's where we're going to be studying tonight. Then trying to slowly, every once in a while, go through yet another book of the Bible to summarize it. The book of Esther is a story about a woman named Esther that takes place between the captivity that was led by Zerubbabel, the return from captivity, I should say, that was led by Zerubbabel, the first return, and the second one that was led by Ezra. So if you wanted to place it in one of the other books, the story of Esther falls between chapter 6 and chapter 7 of Ezra, between those two periods, because there's a gap in that particular chronicle. The author of the book is not known. He doesn't state who he is. The style of the writing is not like Esther and Nehemiah, or Ezra and Nehemiah, I should say. So that suggests, of course, a different author, but we just don't know who actually wrote the book. The author does mention that he had access to records during this time. If you take a look at Esther chapter 2 and verse 23, it says, "Now when the plot was investigated and found to be so, they were both hanged in the gallows, as it was written in the book of Chronicles in the king's presence." And again, he cites this book actually several times, but another place he cites this book is in chapter 10, at the end of Esther. Esther chapter 10, verse 3. He says, "For Mordecai the Jew was second only to the king Ahasuerus, and great among the Jews, and in favor with many of his kinsmen, one who sought..." "And all the accomplishments of his authority and strength, and the full account of the greatness of Mordecai, to which the king advocated, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia?" So again, these records are cited as part of the source. These are places where you could find and verify, according to the author, the story that's being presented here. It is believed that the book was written after Ahasuerus' reign, because in this book, in verse 2 and 3 of chapter 10, he speaks of Ahasuerus as in the past tense, as if the reign has been accomplished. And so this was after the fact. One of the other things that we do know, because this is one of these few books that we can really pinpoint the date, because we have Assyrian records. We also know that during this time that the palace that was in Susa that's mentioned here was destroyed by fire 30 years after Ahasuerus' death. So probably it was between sometime when Ahasuerus died and sometime when that fire consumed the palace, is probably when the book of Esther was written. Can't be absolutely certain, but it appears to be somewhere in that range. Now, Ahasuerus is a Hebrew name for the king. This is the name of the Assyrian emperor as it would be pronounced, or as it would be stated in the Hebrew. His Greek name was Xerxes. And his Persian name I can't even start to pronounce. But if you want to know, it's K-H-S-H-A-Y-R-S-H. And I don't know how you do that with that many double consonants like that. But anyway, that was his Assyrian name. And he reigned from 486 B.C. to 464 B.C. It mentions, actually, a banquet in Esther, and that takes place in Ahasuerus' third year of his reign, which would make it 483 B.C. And what's interesting is that same banquet is mentioned in a Greek historian's account. A Greek historian named Herodotus mentions the banquet as a time when the Xerxes planned to attack Greece. He did lose that war, and Herodotus says he sought comfort in his harem, which was between the time of the contest and the crowning of Esther, probably is what it probably points to. And it's mentioned in Esther chapter 2 and verse 16. So Esther was taken to King Assyrius to his royal palace in the 10th month, which is in the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. And the king loved Esther more than all these women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. So the book basically covers a 10-year time span. Is basically when you get all said and done, the book of Esther covers about 10 years of time. As far as a theme of the book illustrates how God uses basically ordinary people to accomplish and overcome what appears to be an overwhelming set of obstacles to his plans. It really is a book that speaks about God's protection of his people. And yet what's fascinating about this book, God isn't mentioned in this book. Never directly. His name doesn't appear in this book. And yet there's so much emphasis on what God does all the way through. And part of it, I think, is a literary style. They want to, whoever was writing this wanted to make sure that we understood that God works in the background, even when we don't see him. I think it was purposely done to say that, not to mention God directly. And yet we can see his hand all the way through it. Because even without mentioning God, it isn't that the people who are involved are not aware of God, or that they don't seek God's aid. Because it's talked about several times about going and having fasts and other things like that, to seek God's aid. Now, as far as the book itself goes, we won't cover the whole story. We can't go... Actually, we probably have enough time. This book's short enough, you can almost read it. But I won't go I won't do that. Chapter 1 talks about the removal of Vashti. Vashti was the queen of Assyria, Ahasuerus' wife. It mentions in chapter 1 and verse 4 that there was a banquet at this time. And he displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days, 180 days. Now, I've gone to seen some people have parties, but I haven't yet seen one that lasts 180 days. But this is what he was at, this type of banquet he was celebrating. And in that banquet, it was basically men were served in one place and women were served in another place. Because it's mentioned down in verse 9, Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the palace, which belonged to King Ahasuerus. Now, during that banquet, Vashti is ordered by her drunken husband to present herself before her followers, but she turns him down. In verse 10 of this chapter 1, on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehum, Bishtah, Herbona, Bigoth, Abigath, Zetar, and Sarkaz, and the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Assyrius to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, delivered by the eunuchs. Then the king became very angry, and his wrath burned within him. So Assyrius basically asked for advice on how to deal with a rebellious wife. And his advisor said that if he didn't do something, then all the other women in the kingdom are going to hear about it, and they're going to start doing the same thing. Start in verse 17. Of this chapter, it says, for the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, causing them to look with contempt on their husbands, saying, King Assyrius has commanded Queen Vashti to be brought into his presence, but she did not come. This day the ladies of Persia and Media, who have heard of the queen's conduct, will speak in the same way to all the king's princes, and there will be plenty of contempt and anger. If you don't do something about this right now, it's going to spread like wildfire, and everybody's wives are going to rebel. You got to remember, we're at a party where most people are drinking too much. And all the guys are basically gathered together. So, He is advised to divorce her and then find another wife, which is what he decided to do. In chapter 2, basically takes them place several years later. Assyrius began to regret not having a wife. In fact, in chapter 2, verse 1, it says, "And after these things, when the anger of King Assyrius had subsided, he remembered Vashti and that what she had done, and what had been decreed against her, and basically he missed his wife." So the counselor suggested they have a contest. And the contest was to select the most beautiful woman in the empire, was proposed. Candidates were selected from all around the kingdom, and among these was a woman named Hadasha, which in Hebrew means myrtle, but she was also known as Esther, which is a Greek name, which means star. And she was a young woman who was raised by her elder cousin when she was left as an orphan. In chapter 2, verse 7, it says, he was bringing up Hadasha, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had no father or mother. Now the young lady was beautiful of form and face, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So even though he was her cousin, he was old enough that basically treated his father and daughter. And it's important to note in chapter 2 that Mordecai suggested to Esther not to mention her heritage. In chapter 2, verse 20, Esther had not made known her kindred or her people, even as Mordecai had commanded her. For Esther did what Mordecai told her, as she had done when she was under his care. Now, as the contest went on, it was a year-long contest that took place. It was Esther, the one that the king decided he liked the best. And so after some time, Esther became queen. And it's after she became queen that Mordecai heard about an assassination plot that was taking place. So he informed Esther, who then passed that on to the king, and the plot was foiled. In chapter 2 and verse 22, "But the plot became known to Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. Now when the plot was investigated and found to be so, they are both hanged on the gallows, and is written in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence." So a recording was made of that effect. Starting in chapter 3, then we're introduced yet to another character, and his name is Haman. And again, this takes place sometime later, after Esther became queen. He's a man who rose to prominence in the empire. His name was Haman, and we find very quickly that he's a very vain man. In chapter 3, verse 1, "After these events, King Assyrius promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. All the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage." Mordecai refused to bow down to Haman. What we find out is he basically states he doesn't do it because he's a Jew. In verse 4, "Now it was when they had spoken daily to him, and he would not listen to them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's reason would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew." Now exactly what Mordecai had in mind is basically he wasn't going to honor somebody who wasn't above him. Not in that way. Rather than just get mad at Mordecai, Haman decided that he was going to take revenge, not just on Mordecai, but he's going to just wipe out all these Jews. If it's because he's a Jew that he won't bow to him, well, he's just going to wipe out all the Jews. Then he will resolve that problem from his point of view. So in verse 5, "When Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. For they told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Assyrius. Now, we also find out that, and this plays later, we also find out that Haman's a very superstitious man as well. He's vain, he's arrogant, but he's also very superstitious. So before making any move, he consults basically the dice. He has horoscopes basically run to find out when would be the best time to make a move against the Jews. So in verse 7 of chapter 3, in the first month, which is in the month of Nisan, in the 12th month of King of Assyria, Pur, that is the lot, was cast before Haman from day to day and from month to month until the 12th month, that is the month of Adar. So he waited basically almost a whole year, casting lots every day to see, is this a good day? Is this a good day? Is this a good day? Finally, in the 12th month, this is the day to start. So Haman told the king that there was a rebellious people in his empire, and that Haman would be very happy to eliminate them for him before they cause any more problems. And without checking any further, Assyrius gives Haman permission to do so. Starting with verse 8, it says, Then Haman said to King Assyrius, There's a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples of all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of all other people, and they do not observe the king's laws. So it is not in the king's interest to let them remain. If it is pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business, to put it into the king's treasuries. Then the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. The king said to Haman, The silver is yours, and the people also. Do with them as you please. Then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and it was written just as Haman commanded to the king's satraps, to the governors and those who were over each province, and to the princes of each people, each province according to its script, each people according to its language, being written in the name of King Assyrius, and sealed with the king's signet ring. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's province to destroy, to kill, to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, to seize their possessions as to plunder. A copy of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and was published to all the peoples, so they should be ready for that day. So that was, if you remember, that was the day that, when he was rolling the dice, that was the best time to take some action. So the next month he suggests to the king that we need to do something about these people, and the day was set at the end of the year. On the same day he rolled the dice to say, all right, we're going to destroy these people all in one day. Now, in chapter 4, of course, the Jews, since it was spread throughout the kingdom, the Jews, of course, went into mourning when they heard that. In chapter 4, in verse 3, it says, In each and every province where the command and decree of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing, and many lay on sackcloth and ashes. Mordecai also went into mourning. And through a series of letters, Mordecai told Esther of the plot, insisted that she had to ask the king to stop it. But Esther was hesitant because she hadn't seen the king in a month. And if she went into the king while out of favor, she could be put to death. And she wasn't really wanting to take that risk. And there's a key verse, probably the key verse to the book of Esther, which is in Esther chapter 4, starting with verse 13. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, Do not imagine that you are in the king's palace, you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not obtained royalty for such a time as this? And I think this is probably the key to the whole book of Esther. You don't know why you know, just an orphan from a Jewish province suddenly became queen. How do you know you weren't put there? And notice the confidence too, Mordecai had. It doesn't matter if you do something or not, the Jews will be delivered. But if you don't do something, you won't escape. And he's confident in that. Convinced, and Esther calls for fasting, and by that there's implication of prayers that are going on. And for 3 days, she asks for fast until she attempts to approach the king. And in Esther chapter 5 is then when Esther shows her brilliance, because she plays on the very thing that was Haman's biggest weak point, which is his pride. Esther goes before the king, who knows something is bothering Esther, but when he asks, she simply invites the king and Haman to a dinner. That just goes right up Haman's alley. You know, how many times do you get invited to dinner by the royal couple? Just you and the couple alone. And at the dinner, the king again asked Esther what is bothering her. So in chapter 5, starting with verse 6, as they drank their wine at the banquet, the king said to Esther, "What is your petition? For it shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be done." So Esther replied, "My petition and my request is, if I found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and to do what I request, may the king and Haman come to the banquet which I prepared for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king says." She basically puts it off and says, "I'll tell you tomorrow. But if you really want to do me a favor, I would like you two to come to dinner tomorrow too." And so that was done. And again, Haman is beside himself. He got invited personally to spend dinner with the royal couple. Not one day, but now 2 days in a row. But even that was spoiled, because when he was leaving the dinner, he saw Mordecai. And so in chapter 5, verse 9, then Haman went out that day, glad and pleased of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand up or tremble before him, Haman was filled with anger against Mordecai. Haman controlled himself, however, went to his house and sent for his friends and his wife, Zeres. Then Haman recounted to them the glory of his riches and the number of his sons, and every instance where the king had magnified him, and how he had been promoted him above the princes and servants of the king. Haman also said, "Even Esther the queen, let no one but me come with the king to the banquet which he had prepared, and tomorrow also I am invited by her with the king. Yet all of this does not satisfy me every time I see Mordecai, the Jew, sitting at the king's gate." Then Zeres, his wife, and all his friends said to him, "Have gallows 50 cubits high made in the morning, and in the morning ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go joyfully with the king to the banquet." And the advice pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. I'll just get Mordecai hung. Then you can go to dinner tomorrow night and be happy. Only problem was, that very night, the king had trouble sleeping. And by apparent chance, after having trouble sleeping, he decided to read through the records of his council of the king. Probably a great way to put yourself to sleep. Go read the historical records. And there, while they're reading the records to him, they found an entry mentioning Mordecai foiling that assassination plot so many years before. In Esther chapter 6, verse 3, the king said, "What honor or dignity has been bestowed upon Mordecai for this?" Then the king's servants who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." Well, that's not good. Here's a man who saved his life, basically, and we forgot to even say thank you. So, wanting to correct that oversight, he calls for the nearest official, who just happens to be Haman. And he calls in Haman and says, "I need your advice." In Esther chapter 6, verse 6, "So Haman came in, and the king said to him, 'What is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor?' And Haman said to himself, 'Whom would the king desire to honor more than me?' And so he comes up with this elaborate thing of everything that he would like to have done for him, because obviously the king's planning to honor himself. Only after detailing how he wanted to be honored did Haman learn that it was actually Mordecai, of all people, who was to be honored, and he was put in charge of the proceedings. Chapter 6, verse 10, "And then the king said to Haman, 'Take quickly the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who is sitting at the king's gate. Do not fall short in anything of all that you have said.' So Haman took the robe and the horse and the arrayed Mordecai, and led him on horseback through the city square, and proclaimed before him, 'Thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor.'" I'm sure that made his night. And of course, now he can't ask to have Mordecai hung on the gallows, not after he just did this morning. So Haman and his cohorts realized that they were in trouble. So then in verse 12, "Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried home mourning with his head covered. Haman recounted to Xerxes, his wife, and all his friends everything that happened to him. And then his wise men and Xerxes, his wife, said to him, 'If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but surely fall before him.'" And I find that fascinating. They knew, hey, if he's Jewish, he left out that little fact. If he's Jewish, there's no way you're going to win. If God's upholding him, then there's just no way. Which always shows them what the reputation of the Jewish people were. So chapter 7 is the second banquet that Esther had called for. So we got the next day. And Esther at this dinner reveals the plot against the Jews and also lets her husband know for the first time, "By the way, I'm a Jew." In Esther chapter 7, starting with verse 2, "And the king said to Esther on the second day, also as they drank their wine at the banquet, 'What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. What is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be done.' Then Queen Esther replied, 'If I found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given to me as my petition, and my people as my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, and to be killed, and to be annihilated. Now, if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not have been commensurate with the annoyance to the king.' Then King Assyrius asked Queen Esther, 'Who is he? Where is he? Who presumed to do this?' Esther says, 'A foe and an enemy, this wicked Haman.' And then Haman became terrified before the king and queen," which would be an understatement, because Haman had no clue either that he just had signed a death warrant for the queen. And of course, the king's not going to be very happy about that. And the king didn't take the news very well. In verse 7, "The king arose in his anger from drinking wine and went into the palace gardens. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm had been determined against him by the king. He knew he was dead, just waiting for the king to come back to pronounce it. So he begs Esther to somehow spare his life, because she's the one who pointed out it was Haman who did it. But as Haman pleads with Esther, a very weird thing happens. He just happens to stumble. And in verse 8, now when the king returned from the palace garden into the place where they had been drinking wine, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, will he even assault the queen with me in the house? As a word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs who were with the king, said, behold, indeed, the gallows standing in Haman's house, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on behalf of the king. And the king said, hang him on it. So they hanged Haman on the gallows, which he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. In chapter 8, Mordecai is then put in place of Haman. Not just given Haman's job, but he was even given Haman's house. He took over everything that Haman had. In chapter 8, verse 2, the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken away from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai, and Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. Now there was a problem that comes up. It's not actually mentioned directly in Esther. There is mentioned, though, in the other accounts in the Bible. The Persian Empire had an interesting law that the kings were even subject to. And the law was basically that once a law is enacted, it could not be rescinded. It was to make people think before they acted. And that was the intention of it. So you were not allowed to cancel any law that was already in effect. So what do we do about the fact that there was a death warrant for all the Jews, including the queen, in place? Well, an addendum was added stating that the Jews had the right to defend themselves. So they didn't cancel the law, they just said, oh, by the way, the Jews can defend themselves as well. And so in chapter 8, verse 11, I'm verse 11 here. And in them the king granted the Jews who were in each and every city the right to assemble and to defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate the entire army of any people or province which might attack them, including children and women, and to plunder their spoil. Anybody who dares attack the Jews, even though you have the right to do it by earlier law, if you dare do that, they can not only attack back, but they also can attack your family and take your possessions, if they so desire. Which, I think, put a damper on things. And in chapter 8 and verse 16, was a very great celebration of that new addendum to the law went out. Chapter 8, starting with verse 16, it says, for the Jews there was light and gladness and joy and honor in each and every province and in each and every city where the king's commandment and his decree arrived. There was gladness and joy for the Jews, a feast and a holiday. And many among the peoples of the land became Jews, for the dread of the Jews had fallen on them. Everybody was looking at this saying, this is not a coincidence. There's just no way. And people actually converted to Judaism. Belief in God became widespread. Chapter 9 is a detailing of the victory of the Jews. The first half of chapter 9 details how the Jews overcame their enemies. They were attacked for 2 days. You know, the law said only one. But they were attacked for 2 days, and it recounts how they rebuffed the attacks. And at the end of chapter 9, what ended up happening is the Jews decided to establish an annual feast to remember this great victory. In chapter 9, verse 24, for Haman the son of Hammedatha, the Agite, the adversary of all the Jews, had schemed against the Jews to destroy them, and had cast Pur, that is the lot, to disturb them and destroy them. But when it came to the king's attention, and he commanded by letter that his wicked scheme by which he had devised against the Jews should return on his own head, and that he and his sons should be hanged on the gallows, therefore they called these days Purim, after the name of Pur. And because of the instructions in this letter, both what they had seen in this regard and what had happened to them, the Jews established and made a custom for themselves and for their descendants and for all those who had allied themselves with them, so that they would not fail to celebrate these 2 days according to their regulation and according to their appointed time annually. So these days were to be remembered and celebrated throughout every generation, every family, every province, and every city. And these days of Purim were not to fail among the Jews, or their memory fade from their descendants. And basically in chapter 10 is they lived happily ever after, as the rest of King Assyrius' reign. But as we look at this, what do we learn? Even though God's name is not mentioned, we learn that God cares for his people. And God does answer prayers. God doesn't always act in an obvious or miraculous way. Yet he still acts. If you start recounting in Esther all that just happens in the story, there's just way too many of them for a good explanation other than God's behind it. And in those actions, what's amazing is everything seems natural. But the people, and you need to understand this too, people on the side seeing this knew that God was behind it because they converted to Judaism. Also in the story, we also see God's humor. There's so many ironies in this story. He has Haman plan, and then planned to execute Mordecai, turn into that Haman himself had to honor Mordecai. He hangs Haman on the very gallows he planned to use against Mordecai. The feast is even named after Haman's superstitious belief of casting the lots of Pur. What we have to understand is there's so little that we can control in our lives. We think we have control over so many things, but there's so little we can control. And Esther reminds us of who is in control, and that we can depend on God to turn things into good. Paul mentions this in Romans chapter 8 and verse 28. Romans chapter 8 and in verse 28. And we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. God can make everything work out. Even a man who was bound and determined to put the Jews to death. Yet God turned it around and made it work to the point where it brought people to God. We have to understand this is what God is able to do. But we got to put our trust and our confidence in God. Things that look bad, things that look just can't be any worse than this, God can turn it around. And he does make things work out for his people. Which is all the more that why we need to be on God's side. I hope you'll think about these things. If there's anyone here tonight who's not yet a child of God, there's no better time than right now to put on Christ. If there's anyone here who is a child of God, would like to pray as their brethren on behalf. Why don't you come forward if you stand and sing the song slowly?